Welcome. I'm speaking with Laura Cujo today, a museum education consultant and curriculum developer. She's going to introduce us to visual thinking skills.
Hello. Laura.
Wow.
We did it. Hooray.
We did it.
Oh my God.
Awesome. Well, this is, you know, true tenacity.
Yeah. So what happened there? You got the email and you just clicked on it?
Yep. I just got the last one and it just, I went through the same steps of putting in my name and my email, and then it brought me through to the page. So now I see a recording page with a countdown clock and you and me.
Okay, great. Now I hear a little background noise. What's, is there any?
Yeah, oh, it's good to know. This is my air conditioner. Let's try turning it off and see if that helps. Excuse me. Here, I'll turn it just one moment. I'm going to just see if that helps. Hold on one sec.
Okay, great. I'm told two for these things are supposed to sit near a lot of fabric. So I guess being in bed is really good, but whatever you want. It's late enough for that, I guess, right?
Is that better?
That's wonderful. Yeah.
Good.
Totally it.
That's great.
Oh my gosh, it's so nice to see you or hear from you.
I know. It's funny, right? How the
goes in waves. Life
it does
in
go
waves.
In waves. Right. No, that's so true. I feel especially now our sense of time is so fluid.
Yeah, exactly. One day leads into the next month. And
right.
We're just hoping for the end of it all.
Right. No, I think that's very true. I think also it, you want to discover routine, and then the new routine is quite expensive at times. Not always. Sometimes it's really liberating. So it's just, I feel like my perspective on it is the thing that keeps changing more so than I would have predicted. I thought I might have been fixed, but that's actually not the case at all. It's my perspective is also very fluid.
Our theme for tonight, the museums were open again, mm-hmm. And that helps me a lot because that's something we used to do every week.
Mm-hmm.
So it's helped us with our routine. It feels like things are a little bit back to normal.
Oh, yes, that's right. Right. Absolutely. Yeah, that's an interesting point. These things and very literal and kind of figurative things that feel a little familiar, especially in that case, for sure.
Yeah. Except it was a lot different. The classrooms weren't open at MoMA.
Okay.
So a lot of the people we used to see every week weren't there. And Sadie had a total meltdown. She just cried in the middle of a gallery for like 20 minutes. It really hit her hard. But the security guards were really nice about it. They just let her be. Usually they shoo us off and stuff like that, but they were really understanding. So
yeah, I think also there in that environment, so much about what the museum is trying to work through and also working with has shifted. So the colleagues that I know that I think this stands for so many institutions, but particularly institutions that are so used to encouraging their public to be social and supporting that with a lot of staff to engage in that way, those staff are not there. I mean,
yeah, exactly. I mean, for all we know, like the one girl that usually sees is from Ireland. So I don't know if she's gone back to Ireland or what's happening. Now there's a weird sound on your side. I wonder what that is.
Okay, let's see. Do you hear does it sound like water?
Yeah, like a whooshing.
Yeah, okay, one second. Hold on. It's so funny. This is apartment living. That's a bathtub. Well, I mean, we live in a decent sized apartment, but it's a person in the bathtub.
Oh my God.
That's hilarious. Hold on just one second.
Wow. Good.
Isn't that so funny? Good anchor. Juliet, please. Juliet, can you please partially close the door? Just halfway, please. Just please close it partially. Thank you. Okay, fine. Good. Here we go.
Awesome.
So funny. But yes, but I think it says a lot, though, about Sadie's level of, she's a very perceptive young person.
Yeah. Oh, yeah, definitely. And but she doesn't usually she's not very emotive.
Mm-hmm.
Like, it takes a lot for her to get upset.
Mm-hmm.
So it was quite poignant for me, where it just all came down there.
Mm-hmm.
Like, I think she was looking forward to it for a long, long time, thinking it was, you know, she was expecting it to be the same as it was, and it wasn't.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's. I think it's, and even. Oh, go ahead. What were you going to say? Sorry.
Oh, I'm sorry. I'm just glad we went anyway, even though that happened. I'm glad we went.
Right. It's good for all of you, probably, too. You know, once you're on the other side of it, you're so looking forward to it. And as challenging as it might be, once you're on the other side of it, you can.
Yeah. We had
But it's, I think it will be a process. And so many, I've been getting a lot of now, the next wave of emails is the reopening emails. And the conversations we're having as colleagues are about just comparing notes and really about relationship building, how to maintain a relationship with your audience, how to understand what your audience needs. Museums are pretty good. they're really good relationship partners. At least museums in New York are very much tied to sort of meaningful, you know, having healthy relationships. It's quite interesting. There's something kind of sort of psychological on that. You know?
Think they're like snooty institutions, but they're not. The people are right there, and everyone's a working artist, and you know, everyone's studying something on the side, or even that too. In the Natural Museum of History, I mean, the Natural Museum of History is awesome because everyone's a scientist.
Mm-hmm.
They really love to geek out on you and give you all their info. And
Right. I think that the connection with scholarship is something that in a museum environment, ideally, and different people have opinions on whether you say in the informal, quote unquote, environment of a museum. Because when I was going to graduate school 20 years ago, the common language was informal versus formal. And then there were some people who sort of bristled at that. You know, what does informal mean? Does informal mean that, you know, this is a place where there isn't this level of seriousness? You can still be studious and focused without having a certain level of kind of, you can still incorporate play and fun into learning. In fact, so much learning, as we know, happens through play. So when you use that kind of, distinction.
Mm-hmm.
But I think that the connection to scholarship that you're talking about, like especially the Museum of Natural History, is for my children always such a hook.
Because they know interesting facts, unlike us.
Right.
Where we're like, oh, look at the monkey there. Isn't that neat?
Right. Absolutely. The whole, like, everything is different. The vocabulary, the sort of it might be the goodies that they have on a cart in the gallery, or it might be sort of a trick up their sleeve, or just a new way of even making connections between objects that an educator is going to be able to do, because they can help give you maybe just a tidbit of information that then spins your thinking in a whole nother direction.
Yeah. And I know for the little kids, I've noticed they like to give out gross facts and,
yes,
you know,
right.
Yeah.
Right.
Just have fun with them, basically.
Right. There's also a fair amount of when you're a newbie in an education department,
mm-hmm.
there's sort of a healthy level of support that part-time educators tend to give to other part-time educators. And sometimes it's those hook in the audience facts, like the biggest, the smallest, the grossest, the wildest story ever, that it's sort of a part of the indoctrination. Which is kind of interesting. I think it just, people gravitate towards it and usually like some of the readings that we've been looking at and talking about. It's sort of the hook that for engaging visitors is sort of the hook that might connect them emotionally or might maybe jog their memory, because it's got something sort of extra special or unique about it, like what they share, that set of information, you know. And every institution I've worked at has sort of had its different version of that, which is kind of interesting. So, but I think, it's all of those things can make the visitor's experience so much more meaningful and so much more accessible for everybody, even the grown-ups who one would assume know more, but still.
Yeah, exactly.
Know, it's the hook. Yeah.
Yeah. And well, let's just start then. So
sure.
It's so interesting to me, like we've known each other for 5-6 years now.
Mm-hmm.
And then I asked you if we could do a podcast, not really knowing really what you do. And then you passed me on this information and it's no wonder we get along.
Like, yeah.
It's actually exactly what I needed because I was developing my curriculum for this year because I homeschool with my kids. And I was also trying to sort of define our family values, our family culture. And this just really helped me finish it off. Like this really got me going. And it's funny because it's called, visual skills or visual?
Yeah. So
thinking, of course.
No, that's okay. Sure.
Visual thinking strategies.
Right. So the acronym that's used is VTS, but yes, exactly as you say, the visual thinking strategies method is where our conversation, you know, ended up going. Yes.
Yeah. And I think probably just because I'm interested in art and I bring my kids to the art galleries a lot. So that's sort of what got me hooked.
Mm-hmm.
But when you passed it to me, I was like, 3 questions. I'm like, oh, seriously, this is silly. But I mean, I was texting you all the time. As I got deeper and deeper into it, I was like, oh, okay. It's so simple, but it's deep. Like it challenges education and school culture.
Mm-hmm.
Quite frankly, on a deep level. So, okay. But let's explain what it is.
Sure. The acronym VTS and this approach to teaching and learning was something that sort of came into existence, into conversation at the Museum of Modern Art in the 90s. And so it was initiated by a discussion that was happening between the education department and the board of trustees. And really the question was about what are visitors learning? Can you share with us? Can you showcase for us? Can you tell us? Can you prove what your visitors are learning? And just a little context is, you know, my own background is all in museum teaching as both a gallery educator and an administrator. I've worked in museums since 1994. So I'm about as old as VTS, give or take. And I was no spring chicken at that point. So, and so I have not worked at the Museum of Modern Art, but I've just worked with colleagues across disciplines, and I've worked myself in museums of all disciplines, all in New York City since that time, since about 2013-14. So my background is essentially as an educator, as an administrator, as a programmer, not in a computer sense, but more like a workshop designer, a curriculum shaper, both for adults, for children, seniors, for young children, both in a group setting. So if a class of students was coming to a visit museum where I worked, shaping that experience or thinking about what a group of individuals going on a gallery tour or a walking tour might do and learn about. So that's, you know, that's more in a public program, quote unquote, environment. So that's sort of my connection to this. And so VTS was being discussed and kind of the progressive philosophy, if you will, that was shared with us when we were in graduate school. So I was in graduate school kind of around this time. And museums as a whole in New York City have this quite exploratory, open-ended way of thinking about what learning should look like in their institution. So VTS really represents that. This idea that we really want to understand that the visitor, and however old or young or well-educated or perhaps, maybe inexperienced the visitor might be, the visitor comes with the capacity to make meaning, and the visitor comes with a set of lived experiences, and the visitor comes with a perspective that's really important. And so you really want to set up an atmosphere for them to discover. So VTS, as you mentioned right away, is this idea that in a gallery environment, there are a series of questions and they're sequenced, very artfully sequenced, not scripted so much, but sequenced in terms of what it is that you're looking to set up for that experience of discovery for the visitor. And so when MoMA was going through this process and asking these questions, or I should say having to answer these questions, really what they discovered was that their visitors were not retaining the content, the facts and the figures and the numbers and the labels and all these things that one thinks about when you think about, you know, walking into a museum and learning or having a tour and what you're supposed to take away. Mm-hmm. And they realized over time, sort of grappling with that, like any teacher, you're told that your students don't know what you think they're supposed to know. Or, I mean, even as parents, you think, well, why hasn't my child perhaps absorbed or processed or, you know, hasn't there been this quote unquote output, if we will?
But isn't that sort of common? I mean, don't y'all remember being dragged to the museum?
Yes, right.
You know, having to do scavenger hunt and you're just sort of, because I see it a little bit now at the Met. I've seen a couple classes do that.
Yes.
And I just feel really awful. I'm just, because we go and we have fun and they always learn, my kids and I. So so it's that sort of experience they were having, right? And then
I would say they weren't even there. They were one step back, which would be, it was more of a lecture style. Sort of what I was doing 2 seconds ago. You know, where it's just, there's a term that we use in museum education where someone plays the role of being a sage on the stage or a guide on the side.
Mm-hmm. So the kids were being talked at.
They were. That's right.
Yeah.
That's right.
In classrooms today.
Right. Yeah.
So
VTS
strategies that we're going to talk about people have brought this into the classroom to try and change classroom culture around as well.
Yes. And even with very young children, even with children that people say, oh, that's the age group that's really unable to, like they come from a place of deficit right away, you know, really unable to sit still for enough time to ABC, whatever, have a more in-depth conversation of the kind that we're talking about. So the educators, and even now, let's say the families, so the educators that are in classrooms and the educators that are in museums today who've taken on this approach to teaching and learning and are shifting the questions that they ask, it starts at a young age. And really the focus is not so much what's the content. And this is not to say that learning content is not important. That's not the message being sent, but much more about what's happening in the application. How are they using the information they've learned to kind of spark their curiosity to learn more? Or how are they using the knowledge that they've learned and the skills and being able to think critically or problem solve or kind of take their own level of understanding to the next level?
Yeah.
So that's really what it's about.
Teaching them how to learn, how to think.
Right. Exactly. So it's about, you know, you set up this dynamic where the focus is an experience of viewing a work of art and having a very open-ended discussion. So the questions, different educators use different language, but in a nutshell, when MoMA went through this kind of period of self-study and reframed their thinking in how they would teach and learn, we talked about VTS in terms of sort of people to look into and people to kind of read and maybe sort of start to think about pursuing more learning for oneself about this. Philip Genewine and someone who writes in a very accessible way. It's very conversational. It's quasi-academic, but he's one person that one might turn to learn more. Abigail Hausen, who's the researcher who came in to work with them. I would say the language is a bit more dense. And perhaps not that it would be completely inaccessible. I'm not, certainly not saying that. But Philip Genewine might be a person to begin with, or even just to look up VTS and to look at VTS in the classroom.
Yeah, I'll put those in the show notes.
Oh, that's great. Yeah.
Where we read together in the show.
Right. Oh, that's wonderful. Yeah, there's, and the questions are, what do you see? What makes you say that? And what more can you add? Or what, maybe what more do you want to add? But it's, what more can you add is sort of as it sounds, a prompt for kind of additional information. And the way the questions are asked is very much to encourage a social connection within the children in the group, or even if it's two families that go to a museum together, and the parent who's maybe taking the lead initiates the conversation. I do this with my own children. My daughters are 7 and 10. And we obviously are not going to museums as much right now, but the kind of more quiet conversations we have, you know, looking at a work of art, often have to be with, they're really about what they notice. And that word's quite distinct and important, I feel, because noticing, you know, really connects with this idea of what are you personally interested in, which of course is so incredibly important to all of our learning.
Mm-hmm. It validates them.
It does.
It makes them feel belonging. It's mm-hmm. a sense of belonging to the process and that mm-hmm. they're acknowledged mm-hmm. and they're important.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Absolutely. I think, and that important, you want, because knowing the way children are, when you open up that opportunity for them to contribute and participate, there's a level of agency or a certain amount of agency, which I think, as we were talking before about in classrooms, sometimes there's more or less receptivity.
Well, the thing is, in classrooms, if they're just sitting there taking it all in, a lot of kids just numb out. Their brain
yes.
is off.
Yes.
And then, you know, in classroom yes. residential, she points out, too, there's always the one person that answers the question.
Right.
Everyone
right.
else is phased out. And right. There's a little bit of a hierarchy going on there where certain children will not want to participate because they're mm-hmm. shy or they feel like they're not smart.
Right. That's right.
And what I liked about this process is that it validates everybody, and you have to stay very neutral
mm-hmm.
as
mm-hmm.
far as your reaction to the children so that they see everyone's opinion as valid.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. That's right.
I love that. That's probably harder to do at home, is it?
Mm-hmm.
I don't know.
It's a good question. I mean, I feel you can, so when one is encouraged to use this, I worked at the Transit Museum for 8.5 years. I was the director of education for the a small but very busy education department, you know, under the street in our vintage decommissioned subway station in Brooklyn. And we used it with photography, and we even used it with, you know, our subway cars. You know, that was what our a part of our collection. I mean, the museum in and of itself was sort of an object to learn from and to talk about too, the physical space. But if in that environment, if you have a smaller group, or maybe it is a family visiting, to answer your question, you can facilitate a conversation like this because the facilitator, kind of in a way, sort of Reggio Emilia style, if you will, is considered kind of in a researcher capacity where you're really sort of, you take what a child has said and you paraphrase and throw it back out to the group for others to respond to. So you don't own all the information. There's content, of course, one has to know, and it doesn't have to be exhaustive, but enough content to make you feel comfortable. And sometimes that's sort of where you begin, and your comfort level with knowing a certain amount is really kind of based on, for me, what I want my children to learn. So if I want my children to really kind of have an emotional open experience with art, maybe that's as far as we're going to go. And it's not that, you know, more or less, I might not necessarily focus as much on kind of the artistic period or the medium that's used, or, you know what I mean, or the themes of the work. I might just stop there. And the questions that we're having, the open-ended questions, are really just about encouraging them to talk and think and connect with their own feelings and share what they're thinking and feeling. And that's our goal. But the way that I facilitate it is really based on one person contributing and then throwing that back out to the group. Maybe it's a group of three, but this is what, you know, this particular person has said, you know, does anyone else want to make a comment and connection to that? Or is there something else that you noticed?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. And you can weave it together, but the idea is to paraphrase, not necessarily to comment on or feel the need to correct. It's actually kind of liberating to teach like that, really, you know? But that's sort of the way the dynamic happens in the environment.
Yeah, and it's age appropriate. You just, you know, different things are going to happen at different ages.
Right.
And so the idea is that, like, just as you're talking now, I'm thinking about, you know, how my children have changed over the past 2 years of visiting museums and art galleries. And it just builds, and it builds quickly.
Yes. And that's the other part of it, that when you set up an exchange that's based on what they're gaining and learning, and as we talked about earlier on the call, how they're using what they know, it's developmentally appropriate. It's and that was one of the other things that I think MoMA discovered in the process. And the reading also talks about this notion that it's, quote, which is a phrase I love, it's developmentally reasonable. So the children in classrooms who are now being asked to read at a younger age and who are playing less at, let's say, even the age of 5 and 6 especially in New York City, in a large number of public schools. And my children do go to public schools. I'm proud that they, you know, proud that they do. There's a lot of positive that's come from it. But one of the things that one wrestles with, to be transparent, one wrestles with is this developmentally reasonable? The teacher's struggling, maybe the children are struggling. And so I think one of the things about this process is that it allows them to do what you just said, which is to really, you know, to build their own knowledge, to work from their own interests. You know, they can take the lead. They can choose the institution that you're going to. They can design the scavenger hunt or decide, what do I want to do in this gallery? Maybe I want to sketch. Maybe I want to take a series of photos and do a painting when I get home. You know, there's a lot about it that encourages them to develop in so many different ways. And it's developmentally appropriate in that way. It suits, you know, and developmentally appropriate, just to kind of clarify, is not just about skills, but it's when you teach in a developmentally appropriate fashion, you're also teaching very much to the individual child. What are their interests? What are their personalities? What is their culture or lived experience? Like, it's a very whole child way of approaching the teaching experience. The process that happens when one is asking these questions with more and more experience, meaning as the children do this on a number of occasions, their capacity for critical thinking and sort of shifting from observation to inference to interpretation, that's kind of the cycle. I did a project as a consultant. So right now I do adjunct teaching in early childhood education for the Borough of Manhattan Community College. So these are pre-service teachers. And the other thing that I do is consulting work in evaluation and assessment around learning and curriculum. And at the Met, the Metropolitan Museum of Art, that is, there was a project of several years that I worked on where we were looking at high school students having repeated experiences. So within the course of 1 year to go 4 times with their teacher to the museum. And one of the things we looked at, to your point, was just how their experience of this kind of questioning method helped them to not only understand a work of art and start to relate to it, but almost more importantly, to get more comfortable and at ease with the citing their own ideas, sharing their own ideas, and then connecting it with evidence. So looking at the work of art and saying, this is where my ideas are based on, but also synthesizing their own knowledge. So if you think of, you know, the process, when you look at the empty, right now in my head, I have that visual of the triangle of how one's, you know, your thoughts get more and more critical as you move up the triangle. For some reason, the name of the triangle is escaping me. It will come to me later, but it's in educational theory and I'm sure you're familiar with it. But anyway, the idea essentially is, yes, as they go through the process that you talked about in connection to Classroom Confidential, it really encourages them to get more comfortable sharing ideas, connecting evidence to their thoughts, And then over time, developing what their next set of questions are.
Mm-hmm. And as a group.
Don't stop there. As a group. Right. So you can. Group. Right. Yeah. And that's really, this process is really very much about that. It's not, it's never, it's not intended to be finite. So the role of the teacher shifts, or the role of the parent educator shifts, or the role of the gallery educator shifts, and that you're really there to kind of guide them along the journey, but ultimately to encourage them to maybe go to their next museum, or to come home, or to maybe talk with friends, to get a book, to go on the internet, whatever resource it is for you that is something you enjoy working with as a as an educator, as a guide, as a parent, or you know, whatever environment you're in, that really that's what this process is about, building their capacity to understand how to vocalize their ideas and connect with works of art or whatever it is that you're learning from, specimens in a science institution, you know, trees, trees in a park, wherever you are, even studying work of literature, the same kind of thing. You know, you can work with any kind of tool and use VTS and open-ended questions as a tool to be able to help children's thinking develop in this way. That's the thing about VTS, is that's why classroom teachers have figured out, oh wait, this works for me. I'm not an art teacher, you know, I'm not in a gallery, but I can still use these set of questions, the sequence set of questions, to be able to like develop all of these skills in the students that I teach.
Mm-hmm. And I like too how in Classroom Confidential, she makes a point of saying how at the end, you don't give any sort of finite answers.
Yeah.
You don't tie it up in a bow.
Right.
You sort of let it be open-ended so that you can let that continued learning and that child know, you know, there's no wrong, there's no right, there's just exploration.
Right. And that's not necessarily a comfortable place for most people. I mean,
she was saying how right. A lot of students fight it. They really want right. a pat on the back saying so-and-so did better than so-and-so, or, you know, or this is the answer, you know, because they're used to taking multiple choice questions, right. you know, right. This is pretty much the opposite.
Right. That's very true. I mean, there's sort of an acclimatization that happens. There's also a fair amount of skepticism. There's a lot of skepticism.
Yeah. What are you doing? Why are you?
Right. What are you doing? And also, there's also this sense of, is this a runaway train? So we're going to all notice what we notice, and we're going to keep sharing, and we're going to keep connecting what we share to the last thing that was shared or another feature in the work of art. But is there output here? Because I need the output, not outcome, but output, you know, if you think about, you know, big machine processing stuff. But that's not really the goal. You know, the goal before we talked about, with your daughter, for example, building up this kind of repository of experiences, building up this set of lived experiences, ultimately there's critical thinking happening because she's associating one experience with the next, or maybe they contrast each other in some way, and that's meaningful also. But as an educator, really, you can close up whatever environment you're in, close up the experience by saying, where do you want to go next? What questions do you have?
Mm-hmm.
What did you learn? And the children may or may not, but asking more questions is never a sign, as we both know, you know, never a sign that nothing was learned. In fact, it's a sign that you planted a seed. And Zaretta Hammond even talks about this in Culturally Responsive Teaching, that now, especially as a nation, we're finally waking up to how important it is to really understand what people have and what people don't have, and the barriers, the sort of institutional and systemic barriers that are in place. And she talks about her own childhood. And one of the things she said, which really stayed with me because I was just watching a talk about it, she said that creating that thirst for learning for children of all cultures and colors, and knowing when you spark that, when there's a commitment to sparking that in every child, then you know that's when the learning happens, and that's when lifelong learning happens.
Yeah.
That's one thing
and
I love
have
about
that
this.
Their whole lives. They know,
right.
I have a problem. don't know what to do about it, whether it's emotional or intellectual or financial, but let me figure it out.
Right. That's right.
There's always an answer. I just have to find it.
Right. That's right. And I would, you know, I know we had talked about, you know, along the way too, how much content, and I've mentioned this earlier in the call, but just to kind of revisit it, how much content you need to know or have, and at what point do you share the content?
Yeah.
Them, which is always challenging. So if you
it went, is because you can shut down the conversation.
You can
you overdo it. Yeah.
Right. That's right. That's right. And in a gallery setting, as you probably know, also, you know, in this teaching in this way, the educator will quite often not acknowledge label text or dates and figures.
Yeah.
Right. They'll wait. There's a term that I really like. It's a term, it's used in science education, actually, when they talk about a process of discovery. It's actually in the science standards, which is kind of gratifying, that next generation science standards that were put out a couple of years ago. This notion of conceptualization, that a student comes forward with a question or an idea, then they have some sort of experience to help build their own understanding, like in a science experiment. You try it out. Did that work? Didn't it work? How did that affect my thinking? Conceptualization is kind of the place where the student comes with what they've learned, and you, as the parent, educator, guide, share what you've learned. And it's sort of, it can support what they've shared. It can maybe challenge it, but that can be bite size. So that's what happens with the content. That's where the content happens. You kind of share it as you go along, and you might share more or less. It also really depends how much you're interested or how much, you know, it's new for you. It's, you know, there's no one way to do it, you know, but it does have a place. It's just you kind of meet it out as you feel it's right or as the moment calls for. And you might have some days where there's more or less. So you don't.
You don't always get proof that it's working. And
right.
For me, it took, because I started taking them when they were about 4.
Mm-hmm.
And it took till they were 5 for me to really see anything, because mm-hmm. then, well, obviously they're little and, you know, their attention span isn't that great, but I tried to just hook them emotionally at the beginning.
Mm-hmm.
And then by the time they got to 5, we would be on the subway into the city, and they would be thinking about what they saw last and what they wanted to learn when they went there.
Yes.
And
right.
I knew, wow, it's going in. Like, I was actually quite shocked.
Yes, but that's right. So they become sort of there's a term that they sort of become seasoned consumers, but in a good way, right? Where they there's a way too, I think, that I know for us, when my children were younger, I would reinforce in certain ways. So there might be nonfiction books, which I always really enjoyed. There's a really nice collection now, I think, of nonfiction books that are written as picture books that are about artists. And I would say they're not necessarily all created equal, but the benefit of that too, which was kind of nice, is that my children could have kind of their own independent experience at home with the content, and maybe pick and choose what they responded to, or pick and choose what for them evoke kind of memory and meaning being in the experience of being in the gallery together. And sometimes the books, of course, take quite a bit of, you know, artistic license, but that's okay. I think there's something about the fact that, you know, they can connect it to stories. And then it also supports that idea, as you were talking about, in terms of an emotional response. The idea that you build narrative too. So there's, I think you're absolutely right that it does take time, but it's cumulative and generative, and it's about kind of being along for the ride, I guess.
Yeah. And I'm thinking, I'm just, as we're talking, as they get older, you know, you just go deeper. Then they do the essay.
Right.
Then they,
that's right.
You know, have to do the online research. Then they have to interview someone at the museum, and you know, you can just sort of keep layering it as they get older.
You can. And you can also, I think, the way that I like to use this approach when you're thinking about more traditional academic quote unquote subjects is that you can teach in a cross-disciplinary fashion. So there might be aspects of what they're learning, let's say in the study of a period of history, that maybe take a really careful look at the art of the time, or mm-hmm. the poetry of the time. So you can.
Oh yeah, definitely.
You know, there's so that the that also in and of itself supports this idea that this open-ended sort of exploration allows them to ask questions of their own, as you were saying, dig deeper, do their own research. And it also means that the learning is just more engaging because they can sort of say, well, I'm going to gravitate towards that way of looking at this because that's something that I'm going to really enjoy. And so much of this is about that too, about engagement. Yeah.
I guess I guess because it starts with a sense of adventure.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
The whole process is sort of like traveling, or I don't know. There's a hook to it, an emotional.
Yes. Yeah. There is. Yeah, there's a hook to it. There's also we've talked, I know, about primarily about art museums, and there's also in any of the museums, there's also things that you can do that are physical. So taking, yeah. I think kids do intuitively, right? They physically take the shape of something. They sort of personify it. Maybe they make the face or they make the gesture, their whole body. You know, you can do things to engage them physically as well, which works also for children with different learning styles.
Yeah.
But not all children, even if they are of an age where they might sit still for longer, are really successful at learning through having just a dialogue, even if the questions are open-ended as can be, you know?
Yeah, you're right, because it's funny. My kids now have posing contests.
Yes, yes, yes. That's exactly what I was thinking. Right, right.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And at first I was like, hey, guys, you know, let's get serious. But then I was like, no, this is kind of fun. But I could see for little kids, you know, if they pose like, you know, a mummy or whatever.
Yeah.
Or
yeah.
pose like the art, like the figure in the drawing that could engage them as well.
Yeah, and there's also, I mean, when we think about what you notice or what you engage with, there's an activity that they do when they teach at the Met called sculpture in clay.
Oh, really?
If you go to a museum and you have, well, you'd need a minimum, I'd say you'd probably need 3 people. So let's say if you went, you know, with your children and you had one child looking at the work of art and the other child with their back to the work of art. And the child who's not able to see kind of takes on a very relaxed sort of physical posture. And the child who can see gently, tenderly, hopefully moves the limbs of the other one.
Oh, that's cute.
So then, and then the conversation is once you've turned around and looked at it, and this might be more fun with a larger group or pairing kids up maybe to give them a little bit of independence if they're a bit older. But what can you take away from the experience? What do you think that the character or figure or form was thinking or feeling?
Yeah.
And so then that's it becomes cute. A little bit more physical. There's a bit of dramatic play. There's a bit of drama, and I'm sure probably a bit of laughter. I've seen that really successfully work with high school students, with middle school students. You know, you would have to build up to something like that probably. But mm-hmm. there, that also works with a child who is more comfortable learning, you know, who's a kinesthetic learner, who's not yes. as comfortable just sort of give me the visual or give me the auditory, you know, so there's also a lot of room and space for different learning styles within yes. the gallery.
That is way better than dragging someone
through. Right.
And I, as an adult, I hate reading the text like in a sequential manner.
Right.
I need right. to run around and look at everything. I get very excited, but I have a hard time slowing down and being academic about it.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
So I totally understand.
It's, you know, and you there again, we all want that freedom. I know sometimes if I'm going on my own, which doesn't happen as frequently now, but if I'm going on my own, there's also something really wonderful about being able to visit and revisit, and because it's, you know, being in, especially in the cultural institution as well, it's a very it's not the same every time. It's a very dynamic experience, and we're dynamic beings. So the more freedom and we can have to experience in our own way, it goes for adults and it goes for children too. I think the better off we all are. So
yeah, and it's a little bit of quiet too, which is nice.
Yeah, that's right.
So it's very nice and peaceful.
Right, that's right. I think so too. Yeah, and then you can get to the space of contemplation or you know, whatever it is that you're kind of looking for. But I think that in and of itself just supports focus, and it supports sort of an emotional connection to the work of art, which I think above all else is really, it's can be a common entry point for many people. So.
Yeah, I love all your ideas. I think they're awesome.
Thank you. And you, it's been really, always really wonderful to talk to you and learn from you, very much so. So I feel just the same way.
And I think it'll help also too. These ideas will help everyone enjoy the museums more, enjoy the art galleries more, and realize that, you know, it's for everybody, and whoever you are, there's a way to learn and appreciate.
That's right. And also to question. I mean, there's a phrase in the museum community, especially in the last couple of years, this notion that museums are not neutral. They're places of scholarship, but they're run by people. You know? As we look at the Philip Jenewein, right, the situation with, you know, having to explain to the Board of Trustees or to justify to the Board of Trustees. So I think as your children, if you're visiting with older children, sometimes you can also have really interesting critical conversations about what ideas are being shown or not shown. Mm-hmm. You know, there's a lot of layers to the cake, which is
A lot of social exciting. Issues can be brought up.
Right. That's right. Absolutely. Yeah. Absolutely.
A lot of issues around sexuality can be brought up. Mm-hmm. All kinds of discussions can be had.
And cultural experience and, you know, even especially now, I think when you look at, even if you go to a smaller art exhibit, you know, and just figure out a couple of different pieces that you want to respond to and dig a little deeper. And the Met, I know with the high school program I was talking about before, there was a lot of that. There was a fair amount of content the teacher shared, but there was also a lot that the students did in their own sort of journey and sort of skill development in terms of like critical thinking and being able to come up, really feel comfortable expressing your own ideas. And this is, you know, urban high school kids, you know, who may or may not have always felt welcome in the quiet years of the Met. But yeah, giving them that space. So I think you're right. I think there's a lot of space and room. And also it means the children start to feel connected the same way we were talking about feeling connected earlier with being emotionally connected or looking for quiet. That they also can connect in that same way.
Yeah, I agree. Well, thank you, Laura.
Thank you. Thank you very much. It was always a pleasure.
Pleasure with you too. All right. So
okay.
We'll talk later.
Take care. Be well.
Okay. Cheers.
Bye. Thanks. Bye-bye.